Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's top court says 2018's amendment requires all financial obligations to be paid before a felon completes their sentence. So now what?
Given that we know what it means, given that we have to interpret all terms at face value, is that constitutional?
Also tonight, a more diverse workforce is a more competitive workforce. At least that's the premise of one bill making its way through the Florida legislature.
When you don't have a statewide law protecting you, you're left to that patchwork.
Also, we'll have a long chat with Florida's lieutenant governor about her public policy priorities and find out what happened when a very confused guy allegedly stole an idling FedEx truck and took it on a wild ride around Tallahassee's airport. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Well, lawmakers are off today, but they'll be back in Tallahassee tomorrow to begin the second week of the Florida lawmaking session. Meanwhile, the Florida Supreme Court is agreeing with Governor Ron DeSantis that fines, fees, and restitution are part of all terms of a criminal sentence. The question stems from 2018's Constitutional Amendment 4. It restored the voting rights to certain convicted felons. Blaise Ganey has the details on what the court's opinion means.
DeSantis's request and the Florida Supreme Court's take came after federal judge Robert Hinkle ruled felons who can't afford to pay fines, fees, and restitution can't be kept from voting. FSU assistant professor Michael Morley explains the difference of opinion on the opinions.
The advisory opinion simply said all terms of the sentence has to be taken at face value given its ordinary meaning. It means just that, all terms, not just actual imprisonment or probation, but other terms, other penalties to which a person can be sentenced, including fines and restitution.
He says what the Florida Supreme Court opinion does is help the federal courts understand what the amendment meant in the first place.
The federal courts now will just focus on, given that we know what it means, given that we have to interpret all terms at face value, is that constitutional? Does that raise constitutional issues?
Big Bend Voting Rights Project founder Bob Ratcliffe believes the governor should have sent a different question to the courts.
The question he should have asked the court, is it unconstitutional to require poor ex-felons to pay full costs that they cannot afford to pay before they can vote?
Ratcliffe hopes when the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals weigh in, felons will be fine.
I'm optimistic that he will declare this law unconstitutional and clear the way for indigent and individuals to not have to pay fully.
And FSU's Morley says that could be one of the possible outcomes.
So that three-judge court will determine whether or not the amendment's requirements can validly be applied to everyone, whether there has to be a carve-out to exempt certain indigent felons from the amendment's reach, whether the amendment has to be completely struck down, whether it can't be applied to anyone.
For now, Ratcliffe says he is going to continue to register people to vote with the hope that he can get felons registered too. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals is scheduled to hear arguments in the case January 28th. I'm Blaise Ganey.
The most diverse organizations are the strongest, according to most workforce studies. The problem, however, is that Florida has no statewide uniformity when it comes to ensuring job opportunities for LGBTQ applicants. More on that from Talia Blake at Orlando's WMFE.
Nicole Parker began her transition at the age of 19. But it wasn't until her early 20s that she felt comfortable enough to go to job interviews and, as she says, be unapologetically herself.
But it was difficult. There had been times that I would go on interviews and they didn't know until they asked for maybe my identification or something like that, and that hadn't been changed yet. And then how the whole script changes. how I was so qualified in this, this, and that. But when they find out that I was trans, I think it intimidated them a little bit because they didn't know how to go about that. So then all of a sudden, I just wouldn't hear back.
Now, Parker is a stakeholder and community relations manager at One Pulse Foundation and a trans advocate for Equality Florida. She helps educate businesses about the LGBTQ plus community in the workplace.
Because it's one thing to say that you're competent and have LGBT employees, but it's also one thing to continuously have trainings and different things like that to ensure that even if the employees aren't LGBTQ, but affirming and accepting, they still know correct verbiage. And even those who aren't still know how to work around LGBTQ individuals.
Director of Transgender Equality at Equality Florida, Gina Duncan, says her organization has worked to help pass over 40 fully inclusive human rights ordinances around the state.
Education is a huge part of what we do. And I often say one of our mantras is that when they go low, we go local. And we can control things locally.
But there's still no protections statewide for LGBTQ people.
Because when you don't have a statewide law protecting you, you're left to that patchwork of local ordinances.
That's Scott McCoy, who was the first openly gay state senator in Utah. Now he's a senior policy counsel for the Southern Poverty Law Center based in Tallahassee. He wants to see the Competitive Workforce Act become law.
Every year has bipartisan sponsorship in both the House and the Senate, you know, but unfortunately, it's not being prioritized by the leadership in both of those legislative houses.
McCoy says local urgency may not happen until the U.S. Supreme Court rules on Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. That's the law that prohibits employers from discriminating against employees based on their sex, race, color, national origin, and religion. But sponsors of the House and Senate version of the bill are optimistic that it will garner more support this year. Senator Daryl Roussan says there's more bipartisan support for the bill this year, and co-sponsor of the House version, Representative Jennifer Webb, says she also anticipates having more sponsors.
My Republican colleagues keep telling me that they are not the old Republican Party, that they're a new inclusive party.
Nicole Parker feels fortunate to live in a place as inclusive as Orlando, but she says it would benefit everyone if LGBTQ plus people were better included in the workforce.
Like I tell everybody, it pays to be inclusive. If we're talking in the business form, you're going to make more money being inclusive because LGBTQ people work just as everybody else does.
The 2020 version of the Competitive Workforce Act has been filed in the Florida House of Representatives and Senate. Sponsors of the bill say they're working to get committee hearings. I'm Talia Blake in Orlando.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's Lieutenant Governor talks about her priorities as well as those of Governor Ron DeSantis.
But he's also shown that he's willing to address important issues as it relates to the safety and well-being of our children.
In recent years, Florida's coastal areas have often been plagued by toxic red tide outbreaks. The coast seems clear right now, but might the blooms return?
As we start to wind down from this bloom season, we're always preparing for the next one.
And a hijacked FedEx truck causes big trouble at the capital city's airport, which serves many members of the Florida legislature.
And so with that localizer damaged, those planes had a hard time landing, and it caused about 20 flight delays.
Florida's Lieutenant Governor sat down late last week with Capitol reporter Lynn Hatter. Here's that conversation.
Jeanette Nunez is a woman of many talents. Gardening, however, is not one of them.
I don't really do well with plants. I kill orchids, you name it, I kill it all.
What is her thing is state policy. Nunez is leading Florida's census efforts, as well as a slew of other things. Florida is among the last states to form a committee for the once-a-decade count. It determines both federal funding and congressional representation. Our conversation starts here. You're now leading Florida's census efforts, but there's been no state money put toward that. So how are you planning to make this work?
As you know, the governor announced the Complete Count Committee, and he appointed me as chair of the census initiative over the state of Florida. So what we hope to do is capitalize on the hundreds of millions of dollars that the federal government has assigned for this important role, and also work with our local governments. As you know, many of our local governments have really embarked on this initiative for quite some time, and we believe, just like they say all politics is local, we believe grassroots efforts are also local. So understanding that we have a diverse group of stakeholders that are on the Complete Count Committee and will really provide some really key insights and linkages to communities that are either hard to count traditionally or other diverse groups that we're looking to capitalize on the existing resources, and really from a statewide perspective, just lend the focus on making sure that individuals understand the importance of what the census means for our state.
So you said there's federal money available for this?
The federal government set aside a significant amount of funding for the census effort.
The Florida Senate has just advanced a plan to close the gun show loophole and require background checks for private sales. What's the administration's position on this?
So I haven't looked at that, and I don't know if the governor has looked at it. We haven't talked about it. I would suspect that we'll continue to monitor how that bill makes its way through the process. We'll see what the House does. Ultimately, I know the governor is very firm in his Second Amendment, support of Second Amendment rights, but he's also shown that he's willing to address important issues as it relates to the safety and well-being of our children.
How is he when it comes to E-Verify? Now, the governor has staked out a position. He wants universal E-Verify for public and private businesses. Now you have a sort of compromise, an E-Verify light bill that's emerged that would only extend this to government contractors. Is DeSantis all or nothing on this issue, or is there some wiggle room?
Governor DeSantis has been very clear on his position as it relates to E-Verify. He was clear throughout the entirety of his campaign, and obviously he's rolled it out as one of his policy priorities. Again, recognizing that the legislature in the next 60 days has the responsibility of passing bills, of crafting a budget, of taking into account all of our priorities comprehensively, we'll just continue to monitor and see what comes out of the Senate and of the House. And at that point, I guess the governor will make his determination whether he feels it's sufficient enough in terms of his priority.
This year marks 100 years since women earned the right to vote in the United States. What does this anniversary mean to you?
Certainly, personally, I think the commemorating the 100th anniversary is something really special and unique for me. I would not be here were it not for the suffragists of our history. And Florida played a really unique role in that. And so I'm really excited that Governor DeSantis asked me to chair the commission, and we're working with some really great women, spearheading initiatives, making sure that everyone understands the importance of the anniversary, but also working again collaboratively with our local partners and finding opportunities to highlight the importance for young girls today, that it's a very foreign concept for them to think that just 100 years ago we did not have the right to vote. So I think it's a really unique opportunity to highlight the importance of women and men in our history that supported the suffrage movement, but also recognize how far we've come and how far we can continue to go.
So there's one glass ceiling in Florida that a woman has yet to break.
And which one are you referring to?
Oh, another office.
Oh, I don't know about that. We'll see. We'll see. I think, obviously we've got some really great women leaders. We have a lot of people that have been in leadership roles in the Senate and the House. And, you know, I had the opportunity to serve as Speaker Pro Tem in the House, and that was really unique and special. But we'll see. Time will come.
That was Florida Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez talking with Lynn Hatt. A number of bills are moving through the Florida House aimed at helping businesses like craft breweries and local wineries grow. But Regan McCarthy reports not everyone is ready to raise a glass to the plans.
Current law puts a number of restrictions on craft distilleries.
Today, under the law, if you're a craft distiller in the state of Florida, somebody can come in, they can look at all your stuff, but you can't actually sell them a drink.
Claremont Republican Representative Anthony Sabatini says that doesn't make sense. He's sponsoring a bill that would let craft distilleries get vendor's licenses. It would also expand the number of gallons the distilleries are allowed to produce and the number of bottles they're allowed to sell. The measures also give craft distilleries the ability to ship their products. Sabatini says if those companies are allowed to grow, their businesses could be drivers for the economy.
They exist all around the state of Florida. They're roughly, I think, 56 at this point, and they're called craft distilleries, and they bring people from all around the state and all around the country, and people come and they tour them, and it brings new life into parts of your city, helps redevelop the city by bringing an exciting new amenity that people enjoy, going to a craft distillery, seeing how their beverages are being made.
But St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Wengay Newton says the provisions that allow distillers to ship spirits out of state might run afoul of other Florida laws.
I just had a trip out to Lexington, Kentucky, and I wanted to bring back some of their fine bourbon, and I was unable to have it shipped because of the laws in the state of Florida.
Sabatini assured Newton all Florida laws would be followed, but others raised concerns about whether ingredients from outside the state should be allowed in products made by Florida stills. Scott Ashley works with Wine and Spirits Distributors of Florida. He says the craft distiller label needs to mean something.
The Florida craft designation that's already currently in the law has basically lost its meaning because there is no nexus, there is no requirement that it be tied either to the sourcing of agricultural product or the distillation of the product at the premises.
Sabatini says he wants to give distillers freedom to be creative.
Distilling is really, for me, an art form. We should not restrain and constrain these distillers from using only one state's products. If they want to bring in a bunch of Georgia peaches and make the best whiskey in the world here in Florida, but they're using a product from another state, it's not the role of government to prohibit them from doing that. So there's no restrictions on where the material is coming from.
And Sabatini says when it comes to fostering and growing industry, he thinks a hands-off approach works best.
In Europe, in places like Italy and France, it was laughable how much the government actually micromanaged the winemaking industry to the point where you couldn't even label a wine something with new grapes because it wasn't historically grown in that village. They essentially stopped the industry from growing. They hurt the industry. They hurt innovation.
Despite the concern, Sabatini's bill is moving forward. It has just one committee stop left to go. Meanwhile, another bill in the House is ready for consideration on the floor. It would repeal a Florida rule that limits wine container sizes. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Despite Florida's year-round temperate climate, it seems the state's winters are still too chilly for the organism that causes red tide outbreaks. And that's certainly good news for the coastal areas that have been plagued by the toxic blooms in recent years. But the question remains about whether or not those blooms might reappear, chasing residents and visitors from the beaches. Health News Florida's Jessica Mazzaro sought the answers from a noted expert on the subject.
Red tide blooms have pretty much dissipated in the Gulf. Are we in the clear, or is there still a chance toxic blooms could come back?
Yeah, there is a chance that it could come back. But in general, the surface conditions have been really conducive for pushing the bloom both offshore and to the south. That's helped kind of keep things away and off of the coast and then also dissipate it offshore. But the extent to which some of those little pockets of cells that we're still seeing, there's always the chance that that could develop further.
We had a red tide bloom back in 2017 that lasted into 2019. But this past bloom hung around the coast a much shorter time. Why is that?
Sure. Well, we've had a few different frontal systems that have moved through. And in general, in looking at the surface ocean circulation, we work really closely with the University of South Florida, and we have a tool that inputs our cell count data each day, and it allows us to then put it into ocean circulation models, and we can track and predict what the bloom's going to do over the course of 4 days. And we can use that both looking forward, but then also kind of looking backwards to see what the conditions, you know, have been throughout this entire time period. And throughout much of December, they really have been pushing anything that's near shore further out offshore and to the south.
You mentioned fronts. What fronts do you mean? And how did they affect the red tide bloom outbreak this time around?
Some of the cold fronts that have moved through recently, they have impacted Florida, but also, you know, more extensively other parts of the U.S. And those can help change our local and regional circulation.
And what are you doing now to monitor red tide moving forward?
Well, we're continuing to increase our offshore monitoring, and we're doing that with a number of different partners. And that is to keep an eye, again, on offshore patches. That's really important for thinking about, again, whether or not a bloom may come back. But also, as we start to wind down from this bloom season, we're always preparing for the next one. And so keeping monitoring going year-round is really critical to understanding our bloom dynamics in general, why these blooms happen, why they form, why they go away. And so we will continue to maintain our presence in terms of using gliders, autonomous robots, basically, that move through the ocean and collect data using sensors. That gives us information about the conditions that are occurring before the bloom. And that can be really helpful for letting us know if there are certain indicators that might help us understand whether the bloom is likely to be severe or not.
Kate Hubbard, research scientist at the Florida Fish and Wildlife Institute. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Republican Senator Manny Diaz wants people who need emotional support animals to be able to rent condos or apartments without facing discrimination. Ryan Daly reports his bill addressing the issue is advancing, but is facing skepticism from his colleagues.
Similar legislation died last year, but Diaz says it's been refined for this session.
Tailored to specifically to housing. It doesn't apply to hotels or other dwellings. And so that's one change from last year, where it's a little more broad.
Diaz characterizes the current process of getting a certificate to have an emotional support animal as the Wild Wild West.
You can go on the internet and pay a fee, and with one click, you can get yourself a printed certificate that says that you need an emotional support animal. And in many cases, and I, no exaggeration here, we have seen folks who have taken it to the extreme where they are trying to board a plane with an alligator.
It's been likened to diploma mills, a nebulous process that takes place online, phony certificates issued without any defined authority. Diaz's bill looks to get a handle on who's doing the certifying.
What this bill is doing, I don't think it's creating more government. It's just saying, hey, if you're a legitimate practitioner, then you can certify this. And as we do in many other areas, we want to keep those folks who are either not credible or flat out committing fraud from being involved.
The proposal provides protections for people with a certification, which Diaz says he wants given by a medical practitioner. Emotional support animals are commonly used by people like veterans who suffer from post-traumatic stress. Republican Senator Doug Broxson says he's also had personal experience knowing someone who benefited from the animals.
There was a roommate of our daughter in college that had suffered some really traumatic stuff when she was young.
Broxson described how, when tense situations arose, the animal would come into play.
When we get back where her pet was, that pet would come right to her, and you could see a change in her. You could see that she immediately, essentially recovered from the stress.
But some senators on the agriculture panel were skeptical about how the bill would interact with what's on the books. Broxson raised questions.
Are you telling me that if I got a certificate and I have a apartment complex that is absolutely no animals, you cannot even fill out the application if you have an animal? And then I go, after I move in, I go online and I get a certificate that says I am in emotional need to an animal of some sort. That usurps the Landlord-Tenant Act.
Diaz acknowledged the ambiguities and told his colleagues he intends to work out the details on how the two coincide. He says it's not without accountability to the renter, though. Diaz says the bill doesn't let tenants off the hook for any damages to the residents, something he thinks associations and management companies will like.
If the animal does cause damage within the dwelling, there is a responsibility to the owner. And it really lays out the plan for having this. It also makes the falsification or misrepresentation of needing and using an emotional support animal a second-degree misdemeanor.
As far as unconventional support animals go in the context of the bill, a question raised by Senator George Gaynor, Diaz says that would be at the discretion of the certifier.
What if it was a pot-bellied pig or a Shetland pony?
It's that is up to the practitioner.
Kelly Millett, a lobbyist for the Florida Apartment Association, spoke in support of the bill.
I can tell you we've also received support from veterans groups on the matter. They've testified in other committees in the House. I don't know if they're here today. I think there are folks that do genuinely need these types of animals.
There was a companion bill filed in the House, but its sponsor, Representative Sam Killebrew, withdrew it prior to the start of session. I'm Ryan Daly.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. We don't get into a lot of crime and punishment types of stories on Capitol Report unless it involves some kind of convoluted criminal justice bill stuffed down at the Capitol. But something happened away from the Capitol this week that has potential ramifications to impact the people at the Capitol at some point. Are you intrigued? I certainly am. That's why we brought Robbie Gaffney in to talk about that. You've been following it, Robbie. What the heck happened?
Yeah, so this is an interesting case. Basically, an officer at the airport saw someone driving a FedEx truck down the runway. They went to see the guy, handcuffed him, and it turns out his name is Aaron Lenihan. He's about 23 years old. He didn't know where he was, and he's not from Tallahassee. He saw that the FedEx truck had the keys still in the car, like it was still turned on. So he decided to hop in and drive it, try to find an exit, and crashed into what is called a localizer. It helps planes navigate and land when there's low visibility. And so earlier this week, there was dense fog. And so with that localizer damaged, those planes had a hard time landing, and it caused about 20 flight delays.
Is there a potential that we could have a problem with those kinds of flights here, at least in the short term?
A lot of lawmakers do drive. Some of them take charter planes. But there was a possibility that Senator Rodriguez and Senator Flores, they had flights, and those flights were canceled to Tallahassee. So there could have been a possibility that this incident affected them. And actually, with Senator Rodriguez, he was supposed to talk about his teacher pay plan, but he was late and he couldn't present his bill.
And we know sometimes if you do not have a quorum for a particular committee meeting, that scrubs the meeting and it has to be put later on in the calendar, and that can totally mess up the schedule for bill processing during the session. So is there any idea from the airport folks how soon this localizer thing's going to be fixed or what?
Yeah, so the localizer, they've already replaced the structure and now they need to start doing tests. But that is all up to the FAA. And the FAA has said that it might take to the end of January to fix.
We will keep you on deck to try to get us the latest on this situation as it develops. Robbie Gaffney on Capitol Report.
Thank you.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Robbie Gaffney, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Talia Blake and Jessica Mazaros. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us every weeknight at this time throughout the 2020 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org.